drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. It's been a productive few years for Nico Case, a collaboration with Katie Lang and Laura Veers, the seventh album with the new Pornographers, and now her own new solo album, Hell On. She's in Australia at the moment, but it's not for a tour. It's for the Melbourne Writers Festival, where, among other things, she'll be leading a book club on Watership Down. And she's my guest in the drawing room. Hello, welcome. What an honour to have you in here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Why Watership Down?
It was probably the first book I ever read that got me really ravenous about reading novels. Up to that point, I don't know, I was like 8 or 9 or something. Up to that point, I had, you know, read some adult things, but that book, I remember seeing it on my mom's nightstand and thinking, there's a rabbit on that book. Adults don't read books about rabbits. What is that? Is that a kid's book? And I remember looking through it and just going, well, that really is about rabbits. Dang. And so I just started reading it and I got really hooked, and it was really thick, and there were so many details and their lives were so complicated, and I was totally mesmerized by it.
Yeah, was it a bit of a shock when you found out what kind of book about rabbits it was?
Yeah, I had read, you know, Lord of the Rings and stuff, so the violence wasn't shocking, but it was definitely something I related to a lot more than I did with Lord of the Rings. There just weren't really any women in Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
and I didn't realize
you're talking
that at
my
the
language.
Time.
Yeah, like, it was hard to read, wasn't it?
Yeah.
My daughter's reading The Hobbit
at
the moment, and she says, there's only one female character. It's really hard to, like it, but it's hard to get into it.
Thank you. I know.
Yeah. I said, I know. What are you going to do about it, though?
Read it and go. It's just like this half-formed iceberg.
It's half-formed. I don't know. It is half-formed.
It's just floating around out there, being interesting, but
not interesting enough.
Two-dimensional, yeah.
So from that point on, did you become a big reader?
Yes, absolutely. I was totally addicted to stories after that. Very involved stories.
And your house burnt down while you were recording this new album in Sweden.
Yeah.
Were the animals all okay?
They're all fine, which is the only reason I could laugh about it now, but I got lucky.
It's not funny, though, is it?
Well, there are elements of it that are funny, but, you know, like anything, it definitely, it would be better if it didn't happen. But, you know, my boyfriend was there and he's fine. And at the same time, it happened pretty much right as Puerto Rico was underwater. And, you know, the big floods in Houston from Hurricane Harvey had just come through, and so many people lost everything, beyond everything. And I just thought, well, I mean, it's not even a thought. It's just like, yeah, I got out of here pretty lucky, really. Yeah. And I went home, and there was the house all burned up and still standing, you know, but everything was just charcoaled. But it was really interesting to see it in what nature can do to things that humans work so hard to make. It's so immediate. And some of it was really beautiful. Mm. And really interesting.
You were ironically recording the vocals on a track called Bad Luck that same day.
Yeah. Well, I had to right after learning the news, which, I mean, I didn't have to. I could have not gone to work that day, but, you know, what else are you going to do? It's like, I can't go home. I felt very powerless and kind of stunned, really. So the best thing to do was just go to work that day. And
did that help in a weird way to sort of stay busy?
It did. And, you know, I was working very closely with the guys in Sweden, and they were all very supportive and brought levity to the situation and made good jokes and just, you know, slugged me in the arm and said, keep going, little guy. And I'm like, I will. I will keep going. Thank you.
Sounds like it's been a rough few years, though. In addition to the house, which is obviously really very difficult to deal with, you were dealing with a stalker.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great.
Where does one begin? I mean,
just psychological turmoil, essentially. And the United States government and legal system are just as bad as the actual stalker. So you really go to the heart of dark. Like, you can know in your heart that, and in your mind, logically, you can know that women are undervalued and treated as lesser citizens pretty much worldwide. And then to face it in a court of law is a real heart of darkness situation where you kind of go back to square one. Like, those are feelings you avoid by saying them out loud, or, you know, being an activist, or just speaking up for yourself. But then moments like that, it's your humanity is completely compromised, and you don't go bonkers, but you get real
close.
Well,
to
you could
bonkers.
Go bonkers, yeah. But really hyper vigilant and really angry and not pleasant to be around
because your liberty's been stolen from you.
Yeah, and you're also reminded that you never had it. It's all this weird state of mind. Like, you have to believe you have it, and that's not easy.
You've spoken of the rage you felt at the institutions around you when you were dealing with this stalker. Why was it the institutions that caused the rage? What were they doing? What is the institutional problem with the way that we deal with stalkers or with, you know, predators, people who are trying to hurt women?
Well, I don't know how it is in Australia. I'm assuming it's fairly similar to the United States. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I hope it's not the same. But we, as women, if you're being threatened or attacked, you're told you're supposed to go to authorities, people who can protect you, men, in other words. If the authorities don't care, men will not protect you. Men cannot protect you, and they won't. They won't do it. You have to hire people to protect you because the police force won't protect you. They don't have the time.
They don't take it seriously. Is what they say.
They say that they don't. They just don't have. I don't know. They don't think it's worth their time. And then, you know, the courts eventually will do something if you pay them. And that's not supposed to be the way it is. That's what our taxes are supposed to be for. So I spent my life savings trying to make it so this person couldn't, you know, attack me or rape me or kill me. And it was the opposite of the coin of what it's supposed to be. And, you know, you just realize white men can do whatever the hell they want. No matter how illegal, no matter how dangerous, no matter how, you know, and as a really poor person growing up, I thought becoming a productive member of society would kind of shield me from that a little bit. But really, all I am is a good earner for, you know, taxation. That's all I am. I'm not a member of society. I'm an earner. So I don't make enough for them to protect me, but I have enough to spend. And I remember being a young person and being really poor and having to deal with those things. And I don't know, you don't ever get to a place where you can be protected. You just get to a place where they can take your money. Whereas if you don't have any money, they don't do either. And, you know, often just kind of ridicule. Actually, I remember cops laughing in my face as a young person dealing with those things. So they're not helping. And I'm not even going to say the whole, yeah, there are good ones out there. Because, yeah, no doubt there's good ones out there, but there's very few.
That's not what you encountered.
No, and it's not what the law says either. You know, so it's not a real system. It's just.
Do you feel safe now?
I was never so much scared as I was angry. I was a lot more worried for the people around me. It was destroying them. And me being destroyed, I was used to. But watching people I cared about be destroyed is what really got to me.
You've been doing a lot of research over the last few years into the history of how women have been treated. You know,
when did we start hating women? I had to know.
Did you figure it out?
I got closer. I read a lot of books. They didn't make me less angry or more angry. They just made me go, okay, that makes sense. But then there was a book I read by a woman named Adrienne Mayor, who wrote a book about Amazon warriors. And she, along with the help of scholars and historians, figured out that Amazons were actual people. They weren't mythological at all. And Amazons weren't just women, but they were men and women who lived in a more egalitarian societies. And they covered most of Asia, Europe, Central Asia. They went down into Africa and India, China, all over. And the big element of equality was horses. And the way humans were evolving with horses and becoming horse cultures, because horses made humans the same strength as each other and as fast as each other, etc. So it was a great equalizer. And so from that book, I started understanding more and saw some of those women that had kind of been erased. And I felt so validated because I always knew they were there. It's just the whole, well, women weren't ever allowed to do anything in history, and that's why we don't read about them in history, has always seemed like such a convenient blanket. And it's totally not true. We were there. And the book talks a lot about the stories and the mythologies and the parts that are actually true. And the book was really joyous and excited. And I actually met with Adrienne Mayor, I think right before the election. And she just talked about how excited she was to meet all these younger people who were going back to find people and bring them back out of history. Mm. And bring them back up to the light, and how new technologies like DNA testing really helped out. Because, like, for example, there were huge, you know, warrior grave mounds where there would be many, many warriors, you know, and even people like Genghis Khan had many warriors who were women, but they could never figure it out. They always thought they were always men. But with the DNA testing, they were learning that like 30% of these cultures would have female warriors. And it just seemed, I don't know what the word is. It was just very validating. Like, yeah, I always knew we were there. And, you know, I took art history for many years and had a 3-inch thick book with 5 women in it. It's like, this is the most expensive book I've ever bought. Yet, there are no women in here. That just doesn't seem possible.
It,
like,
does
I know,
seem odd.
It is. And I know what it means to have a human will and human desire. And I can't imagine, even if we were just passengers or slaves, like they claim, that we wouldn't have been there more than that. So that whole argument is totally fake and false and wrong. Thank goodness.
It sure is. Let's talk about the new album. It comes off the back of 2 collaborative projects. Was it nice to get back to your own space again?
For this record, it really was, because I felt really confident and really present, and I was really excited to make another record. I felt so ready.
Mm. On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis, and Nico Case is with me in the drawing room. We're about to hear a track off your new album. What have you picked for us?
This is the title track off the new record called Hell On.
Tell me about the song.
It's kind of a song that's written when I'm not, like, I have something I want to say so badly, but my standard limited English doesn't cut it, so you make collages out of English into poetry and into sounds, and you kind of make a strange off-to-the-side language that's kind of a hybrid, which is kind of the definition of art in a way.
This album, you said you were so ready.
I was so ready. So excited.
Were you?
Yeah.
What made you so ready?
Well, I think, you know, I'd had some really hard years of dealing with depression, you know, losing my parents and my grandparents and stuff. And that was a deep slog, which I was not that into. And the worst things get was, I thought it was a good album, and I'm glad I made it, but I didn't enjoy it. It was made despite being really depressed rather than a catharsis or anything like that. And then I went into working with Laura and Katie, and that really felt great, and I learned a lot of things from them. And then going back with the new pornographers was really fun. We had a great tour, and it was so nice to play with them again. And then I think the thing that really capped it off was I went to the first ever in the history of the world, the first ever women producer conference in Brooklyn, New York, which was set up by two women, Melissa Dine and Kayla Maritich from a band called The Blow. And they set it up on a shoestring budget. And it's totally shameful that it is the first of its kind. But there were women from...
In what year? Last year?
2016. It was called Woman Producer. And they had women from all over the world, from all different backgrounds, come and speak at this event. And some performed. And, you know, for women like Pauline Oliveros, that was her last performance before she passed away. And so major that she got there and performed and kind of got her due as being a producer. It was a very inclusive event. And I just remember, you know, like I said, it was a shoestring budget. So we're in this tiny theater. And the panel I went to, there were six other women. And we were all sharing the same dressing room. And usually, you know, I'm pretty shy first meeting people. And, you know, knowing some of these women now, they're kind of the same. And but I remember getting into the room and there was the initial politeness, but it was hardly observed. And we all just burst into conversation. We could not stop talking. We had been starving for that kind of dialogue with other women who work as producers and musicians and creators. And it was a really heavy event because it was on one hand really joyful and hilarious and there was so much camaraderie. But I remember at one point on stage sitting there and we're in front of a huge mixed audience of human beings from all age groups and genders and backgrounds. And we're sitting on the stage and not only was I being the representation, I was seeing the representation at the same time. It was this crazy meta experience of being validated by seeing, you know, people who are like you doing what you do. And it was so excellent and so beautiful. And I don't think I've ever felt that way before in my career. I felt like people must feel when they win the Oscar for Best Picture or something. But it was great because there were no prizes. It wasn't about prizes or competition. It was about celebrating music and creators. And that's the greatest moment of my career, I think.
Nico Case, it's been so amazing to meet you. Thank you so much for coming to The Drawing Room.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nico Case has been my guest in The Drawing Room. Her new album is called Hell On, and she's appearing at the Melbourne Writers Festival. Now let's have a listen to her song, the title track of the album, Hell On.
God is not a contract or a guy. God is in a specified tide. You cannot time its tables. It sets no glass or gables. God is a lusty tire fire. Its bristles scrape and strike the stage. Arrive.